Good evening and welcome to tonight's special program of the Commonwealth Club of California and St. Mary's College's School of Economics and Business Administration. I'm Dr. Shyam Kamath, Associate Dean of Graduate Business and Global Programs at St. Mary's School of Economics and Business Administration, and I'm here with my colleague, Dr. James Hawley, Professor of Management and Economics and the Director of the St. Mary's Elfenberg Center for the Study of Fiduciary Capitalism. We will be your moderators for the program. Tonight, we will have a discussion about corporate social responsibility in a post-global economic crisis world and examine the realities, prospects, and solutions. The global financial crisis and its aftermath has left the world in turmoil and facing uncertain prospects with uneven and slow growth, as was represented today by the combined demonstrations in three countries in Europe. The events leading up to the recession have also generated greater scrutiny of business. What was corporate America's role in creating the Great Recession? Were only certain sectors of the economy to blame? Could better corporate governance have prevented this from happening? The momentous changes of the last 5 years have resulted in a clamor for business to rethink the role and responsibilities towards society that they have. Better governance and responsible leadership are being demanded by stakeholders and shareholders alike. What does business need to do to reposition itself in the current environment to provide active and responsible leadership while reigniting economic growth to better the lot of mankind? We have seen the ratings of business leaders drop like those of politicians since the financial crisis. These are the questions that we hope to tackle with our distinguished panelists to try to find answers and solutions to some of the biggest challenges to our prosperity and well-being in these uncertain times. Our outstanding panel of three experts on global business and the nonprofit world will discuss these, actually I should say, and the social enterprise world, because Goodwill is a social enterprise, will discuss these and other pressing issues in this annual Global Economic Forum. And now I will hand this over to my colleague Jim Hawley to introduce our distinguished panelists.
Thank you, Sean. I'd like first to introduce Michael Fox, who is sitting in the middle here, for those of you not in the radio and internet audience. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Goodwill Industries of Silicon Valley. Goodwill Industries International is a not-for-profit organization that provides job training, employment placement services, and other community-based programs for people who have a disability, lack education or job experience, or face employment challenges. Goodwill is funded by a massive network of retail thrift stores, which operate as nonprofits as well. Goodwill operates a network of 165 independent community-based organizations in the U.S., Canada, and 14 other countries. In 2011, Goodwill collectively earned more than $4 billion and uses fully 82% of that revenue to provide employment, training, and support services for more than 4.2 million individuals. Mike has over 25 years of experience in redefining business processes and penetrating new markets for companies in wholesale and the B2B service sectors. Previously, as president of ME Fox and Company, one of the Bay Area's leading wholesale beverage distributors, he was responsible for reversing a three-year decline, driving revenues from 28 to 60 million. Mr. Fox is the past chairman of Silicon Valley San Jose Chamber of Commerce and has held numerous leadership roles in local and regional charities. He received his BA from the University of San Diego and a transglobal MBA at St. Mary's College of California. Our next distinguished panelist is Dr. Peter Graf, who is sitting two people to my right, who serves as Chief Sustainability Officer and Executive Vice President at SAP. SAP AG is a German multinational software corporation that makes enterprise software to manage business operations and customer relations. Headquartered in Waldorf, Baden, Württemberg with regional offices around the world. SAP is the market leader in enterprise application software and the world's largest business software company. The company's best-known software products are its enterprise resource planning applications, enterprise data warehouse solutions, SAP Warehouse, SAP Business Object Software, and most recently, Sybase mobile products and in-memory computing appliance. Dr. Graf oversees strategy and innovation for sustainability solutions and operations. Previously, he was the deputy chief marketing officer at SAP. He was also co-inventor of SAP NetWeaver, the company's software platform, which is now a vital contributor to SAP's financial success. Dr. Graf holds a master's degree in computing science and economics from the University of Kaiserslautern, as well as a doctoral degree in artificial intelligence from the University of Saarbrücken. Our final panelist sitting immediately to my right is Kapril Sharma, Senior General Manager, North America, Tata Sons Limited. Kapril heads and manages North America's office of Tata Sons, the $90 billion Indian multinational conglomerate that operates in over 80 countries with a global workforce of over 425,000 and which owns such well-known businesses as Jaguar, Land Rover, Daewoo, Corus Steel, Marco Polo, Taj Hotels, the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Boston, and Campton Place Hotel right here in San Francisco. The Tata Group of Companies was ranked 11th most reputable company in the world by Reputation Institute. Prior to rejoining the North American office, Kapril served as the general manager of Tata Services based in Mumbai, India. Kapril's primary focus primarily focused on global branding and communications. He also assisted the Tata Group companies on issuing such innovation as climate change and business excellent quality management. Prior to joining Tata Sons, Kapril was the vice president of Madison Government Affairs, a boutique government relations firm representing non-U.S. clients and U.S. public entities before the U.S. Congress, administration, and various federal agencies. Kapril also has extensive political and grassroots experience, having consulted on numerous federal, state, and local campaigns. He served as senior counsel and legislative director to U.S. Senator from New Jersey, Robert Torselli. Kapril received his J.D. from Rutgers Law School, his B.A. from Rutgers University. He is also a member of the Maryland Bar Association. We look forward to a lively, illuminating, and educational discussion from our distinguished panelists. We will begin with each of our speakers making about a 15-minute response to the initial questions that have been prepared to focus on key aspects of today's topic and then get to audience questions. We will begin with Dr. Graf.
Beautiful.
All yours.
I think you have to ask those.
You're right. I have more to do. Thank you very much.
It gives me some degree of freedom.
It certainly does.
Exactly.
I'm going to constrict you now. Europe is still undergoing the effects of a global economic crisis within the European Union, which is in disarray, and countries like Greece, Spain, Italy, and Portugal on the brink of bankruptcy and default. The EU is in danger of fragmenting as tensions mount on large and small scale across its regions and across nations. From Scotland's independence referendum to Flanders' autonomy to the now Catalonian separatism on the rise once more, this is no longer simply a north-south divide, but a rich-poor debt-in-debt divide. As the New York Times has noted, this seems to emerge from the ebbing concept of shared sovereignty, richer or less debt-saturated nations increasing anger at having to bail out their poor neighbors, or, as Stratford describes it, the paradox of integration, as apparently good things mean vastly different things depending which side of the fence you sit on. What does this portend for the world economy, and especially for the developed world and the United States? Is a double-dip recession inevitable for us being both the U.S. and Europeans and perhaps others? Does that imply that the European Union, or at least the euro, is fundamentally untenable? Will this impasse pass, and is Europe likely to get its act together? It is an interesting question to ask what blame the public government sector has to take versus the private corporate sector, especially banks and financial institutions, but also corporate giants such as Siemens and Vivendi, for the current difficulties. Were only certain sectors of the economy responsible for bringing about the collapse, banking, real estate, finance, and the like? Are other sectors unblemished, energy and manufacturing, for example, by these events? Should one sector or the other have greater responsibility to play a leadership role in getting the EU out of this mess? What role is the state and EU-wide policies to play? Austerity versus bailouts, or alternatively, growth policies and perhaps bailouts as well? How is the EU-wide policy related to corporate policy? Does the crisis and post-crisis period redefine CSR as traditionally understood? Should it? You have 15 minutes.
Yeah, let's solve this real quick. When I saw the questions for the first time, I read them again and then again, and I tried to structure that. So I can assure you I do not know the answer, because if I did, I wouldn't be sitting here. I would be sitting somewhere in Brussels, maybe at the European Central Bank, fixing this thing. But I'm a computer scientist by training, so I like to distill the patterns in a problem so that we get closer to a solution. And as such, I've thought long and hard, longer than my wife actually wanted me to think about all these things, and I have distilled it into 7 statements that I would like to share with you today that hopefully provide some insight and maybe some provocation, intellectual provocation, obviously. The first statement that I'd like to make is that there is no viable political or economic alternative to European integration and the European Union. And you have to see that in the bigger scheme of history. When you go to Wikipedia, and that's what I did, and you look at the last 1,000 years in Europe, there were 500-plus armed conflicts between nations in 1,000 years. So after the devastation of the Second World War, the countries in Europe came to the conclusion that if they continue doing what they do, that's just not a good way of creating a future. So back in 1948, the first attempts of creating a union around coal were started, and they evolved. They became the Treaty of Rome. They created the European Union. This idea of European unity is much bigger than any currency crisis you can have, and I just wanted to lay that out. So politically, not a big alternative. Economically, also not a big alternative, because Europe wants to compete with the rest of the world. And what the European Union did is created one huge market of 500 million people, which, if it were one country, it would have the largest GDP of all countries in the world, $17.6 trillion in 2011. So it's been a success model because it creates an environment where you have free exchange between goods and services and people and capital without any boundaries. No customs, everything much, much faster and efficient. So one thing remained, and that was the uncertainty of currency exchange rates when you do business in such a market. And that's what led me to statement number 2. The euro is designed as a one-way street. What that means is that there is not even a contractual possibility for someone to leave the euro. It's a decision you make once, and all the contracts are written in an assumption that this is an unlimited affair. It is enduring forever. There is no way back to a currency. And honestly, even with the turmoil, very, very few people believe it's a good thing to drop the euro, and I can tell you why. The euro was designed as a very stable currency. And again, that needs to be seen in historic backgrounds, because in Germany, the Germans lost their currency twice after the World Wars, every time there was inflation, hyperinflation, and the currency collapsed, the financial system collapsed, and people lost everything. My grandma, she had to restart twice, not just once. My mom had to restart once. And that's still very much in the psyche of the Germans. So when they had to give up the good old Deutschmark, they designed a currency that was built around stability. And there was a stability pact. You can at most have 3% of your deficit, or 3% of your GDP, that's the maximum deficit you can have, and your total accumulated debt is 60% of your GDP. Those are the rules of the euro. Unfortunately, France and Germany broke those rules in 2004, 2005, 2006, setting a relatively bad example. But why do people not want to drop the euro? If you think in terms of the European Central Bank, and they define the interest rate for the euro just like the Fed does, They control the amount of money that's floating around. So there are very strong economies in Europe, like Germany, and there are weaker economies in Europe, like Portugal. So what the European Central Bank needs to do is find an interest rate that's kind of in the middle. And what that does is it creates a better exchange rate for Germany to export. So the Germans would be stupid to have their own currency because it would be of much higher value than the euro, making it harder to export stuff. And for the Greek, for example, getting out of the euro would actually deflate their currency so much that they would never, ever be able to repay the debt. So that needs to be understood. But we're talking about all these things. The third statement is really what kind of leads me to what I really want to talk about, which is sustainability. The euro crisis represents the dilemma of political leaders worldwide. Because here's the trick. Political leaders in Europe know exactly what would need to be done, what would have to be done to solve the problem on a grand scale. But if they do so, they will not be reelected. So for those people who force austerity measures in those companies that have countries that have all the debt, it's a very unpopular thing to do. And even worse for the countries that have the money, like Germany, if the Germans feel like they have to pay the pension plan of a Greek worker, Angela Merkel is not going to be reelected. So it's either doing the right thing or be reelected. The same with the power structure in the European Union. The only way to solve this is to give more political power to the Union and take authority away from the different countries, 27 countries. But which politician would do that? So that's the dilemma that I see. And interestingly enough, we, the people, we have accepted this as a viable dilemma. I was surprised when I heard commentators after the election here say, now Obama can do what he wanted to do because he has been reelected. I mean, wouldn't you believe that, you know, being elected is enough reason to do what you think needs to be done? So that's the dilemma that we are in. And that's why I do not have much hope for regulation. So if you wait for regulation to come and solve the problems of climate change, energy scarcity, poverty, and all these things, you can wait for a long time because politicians find themselves in that dilemma. I cannot harm a large enough group of people because then I will not be reelected. Now, who will solve the issue then? So I went back to Wikipedia, what a wonderful tool, and I looked up the revenue of some of the larger corporations in the world, and I didn't even have to go all the way to the top, because the annual revenue of Toyota is bigger than the GDP of Greece. Okay? So there is a responsibility, there is an opportunity for businesses to take action. Now, home turf, Peter Graf. Welcome, everybody. Statement number four, sustainability is what I see is the biggest transformational force in play today from a business perspective. You can compare it to globalization or the arrival of the internet. It changes everything. And some people understand that pretty quickly, and those are the companies that we admire, the Danones, the Nikes, yeah, the BASFs of the world, because they see an opportunity to innovate, because they understand we've got all these people in the world, and we need to find a way to go and feed them, to provide goods and services to them. By 2050, we'll not only add 2 billion people on the planet's face, we'll also add 2 billion people into the middle class. And they all want to live like you. And there's just not enough stuff, not enough energy, not enough material to get that done. So that's the challenge they see. And what these companies do, those leaders, is they create a competitive advantage. They create a first-mover advantage. And we'll talk about how they do this in a second. And then there are the others who wait for regulation. And they wait for something to happen, and they will comply at the lowest cost. And in so many other transformations, those guys got lost in the transformation. And maybe that's what needs to happen. Statement number five. The sustainability business case is easy, but it needs to compete with all the other business cases that happen within a company. And trust me, I live this every day. Because when I go and say we should build this product to help companies optimize their supply chain or to ensure there is no slavery-like working conditions in their supply chain, I need to make a business case. How much money are we going to make as a software company with that type of product? And are we going to make more money than with all these other ideas that we have? So the price that you pay by working within the system and not outside of the system. That would be demonstrating in front of SAP holding up signs, bad, bad company. But going into SAP and changing it using the rules of business, that's what needs to happen. And companies are doing transformations for very, very selfish reasons. So the first is they want to reduce costs by consuming less. So, for example, SAP, we saved $250 million over the last 4 years by consuming less, by having more intelligent ways of operating our company. That's a substantial saving. The next way of working the business case is to sell more by innovating across your value chain. So Danone, for example, they carbon footprint 35,000 products every month using software. So they find the embedded energy in, let's say, a yogurt, so they can go back to the supply chain and optimize the supply chain, because they would not see these inefficiencies if they only asked for the price of the components that make up this yogurt. In other words, Pepsi did the same thing. They analyzed orange juice. More than 30-40% of the carbon footprint of orange juice is in fertilizer. They went to the farmers, taught them how to be more profitable, and got the oranges at a lower price. They would have never gotten that if they had just asked for the price of oranges. So by looking at different ways of optimization, you find inefficiencies you didn't find before, and you put that big sticker on your product, we reduced our carbon footprint by 30%. That's actually what Danone did, doing that. So you become more attractive to consumers. Other companies, they reduce risk, and that's specifically true for those companies that are at the beginning of supply chains, the mining, the extracting industries, the oil industry, the chemical industry. They want to reduce risk, because that's where, you know, the biggest damage to the brand, the biggest damage to the business can happen. Think about oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico. And then there are companies who increase brand value. I drove in, I heard a wonderful ad on the radio about saving the polar bears from Coca-Cola. Certainly driving brand value for Coca-Cola, you know, with the beautiful cans and the bear that everyone confuses with the Coca-Cola light, because they've got kind of the same color, but different conversation. Statement number six, sustainability must happen at the core of value creation. And that is the most important sentence. So here's the thing. SAP creates software, and we do many, many other things. If I weren't in charge, partly, of the software creation, I would be completely irrelevant for most of the people that have something to say in this company. If you're in a company like Coca-Cola and you're in marketing, that's where the value is created. If you're in Walmart, the value is created in the supply chain. That's where the focus needs to go from a sustainability perspective. If you do not tie it to the core of how the company creates value, you will not be able to transform the business. And I've seen this day after day after day, because as someone who is not only building solutions for sustainability, software for sustainability, but selling it, I need to make that case every day. Now, the ultimate frontier that I hit every day, interestingly, is not our customers, it's not our partners, it's not our executive board or leaders within the company. It's the employees. It's the 64,000 people that need to come with me on the journey. Employee engagement has become such a dramatic challenge, because people hear many different things and they want to be taken, and they want to understand what's in it for me. And the problem is, to the outside, it's all about the business case, but inside, people don't do it for the business case. They have much more social reasons to do that. They want to create a better world for their children. If I tell them we saved $250 million, they say, so are we now a cost-saving measure here when we do sustainability? So that's a huge challenge, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later in the questions. Wink. And last but not least, there is a big trend in combining the sustainability reports with the actual annual reports. And that is very, very important, because it is an integrated report that results from integrated thinking. So that's a huge movement, too, that actually, again, manifests that you need to bring sustainability to the core of how the company creates value. Statement number seven, we're almost done. And I'll say that slowly, because it's also very important. The success of those businesses that lead depends on you. For a very simple reason. In the past, we were reading the newspapers, we were watching TV, and it made us feel alone. The world has fundamentally changed. There are now more connected devices than toothbrushes. Yeah, I've seen a beautiful picture of a person having his phone on his ear and very bad teeth. So the decisions we used to make alone become a social phenomenon. Who we work for, where we invest our money, which stock we buy, who we vote for, what we consume, those become social phenomena. And if you don't believe it, ask your kids. It is a social phenomenon. By the way, there are whole, you know, governments in North Africa that stumbled over social phenomena. And that's the hope that I have, because if we're only looking at those few companies that are driving sustainability, they need to feel your love, because they're doing something fabulous. They understand the bigger picture, and they look at the intersection of their own economic drive, their responsibility for the environment, and what they can do for society. And where those overlap, that's where sustainability is core to the value creation of a business. It's on us to change what's happening right now in the way how we consume, who we work for, where we invest our money, who we vote for, all those kind of things. Thank you.
Peter, thank you very much. You had my vote for Chancellor. I think now you have my vote for President of the European Union. I wish that kind of thinking was implemented. I thought you made a very good case for the reason that sustainable enterprises need to be supported by us as consumers, and the seven reasons for why the world will be a better place. So thank you very much for the insightful comments. It's now a couple's time to stand up to the big questions. So I'll provide the lead-off question for Mr. Sharma. How is and what is Asia doing as the world economy slows again, and the developed world, particularly Europe and North America, seem mired in stagnation and slow growth? Is the recent slowdown in India and China a harbinger of troubles for the world? Is it for the rest of the nations in Asia's economies? Or is Asia prime for another crisis? Now, I know, couple, you have a wonderful crystal ball that you look into, but is this going to lead to the growth of protectionism again and disputes in Asia? What is the future of India and China with Indonesia and Southeast Asia and Russia waiting in the wings? As a corporate officer of Tata Sons, whom I have got to know very well over the years, and the owner of the Tata Group that has exemplified corporate social responsibility, it is one of the most reputable companies, certainly in India and Asia, but also in the world, as the Reputation Institute points out. What role do you see for multinational corporations from developing economies like the Tata Group in leading corporate change to a cleaner, more transparent, and responsible business world, in the sense of worrying about planet and people, social issues, from an ethical point of view? Specifically, what role does corporate governance play? And I know that in the Tata Group, that's a very important issue. And what does socially responsible leadership play in avoiding corporate debacles like the ones we have witnessed, at least in our country, or the country that you also grew up in and live in, during the last 4 to 5 years, which led to the global financial crisis? Could you also give us a feel for how the Tata Group has reached out globally? We know you're in 80 countries, to create what Peter would have called a sustainable enterprise, an enterprise that we all need to support.
Okay.
All right.
I want to, first of all, I have some Indian Americans that are in the audience, and I want to wish them a happy Diwali. Diwali was celebrated yesterday, so happy Diwali to you. And I'd like to thank Dr. Comet, St. Mary's College, and the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to participate on this very distinguished panel. I don't thank you for having me follow Peter, because that was very good. But it is a true honor to be on this panel. And it's actually also very nice for me to speak about something outside of the presidential elections and the impact of the elections on U.S.-India relations, which I've been doing for the last 6 months. About 6 months ago, I had hair just as nice as Peter and Michael here, and this is what 6 months of the election has done to me. And it's funny, because people always say, you know, why is it so hard to talk about the elections? But 4 years ago, when I was living in India, the U.S. consulate had asked me, because of my background, to do a little bit of a road show around Western India to talk about the impact of the presidential elections. And so I got up and I talked, and they always read my bio. And when, you know, generally speaking, when you're an American speaking in India and you're talking about politics, inevitably the first question is about why do you love Pakistan so much and hate us so much? And so I was quite prepped for that. But sure enough, on the first event that I did, the first question that was asked to me was, is everybody in New Jersey like Tony Soprano? And I said, wow. I quickly called my friends at the governor's office and said, we have to work on better brand ambassadors for the state. There's a lot of stress there. But, you know, actually after reading Shyam's questions, what he had sent to us ahead of time, I actually want to go back to talking about Tony Soprano, because I, too, if I had the answers to these questions, I'd be in a much different position, making probably a lot more money as well. You know, when I looked at these questions, I thought it would be best to first really talk about our group, or the Tata group, and to explain to you, because people really don't understand what the makeup of our group is. And once you understand the group, how we're set up, I think you'll appreciate how we approach sustainability, how we look at geographies around the world, and what makes us unique, and what we feel sometimes makes us the company for the future, the model of the future. We are a very large group. We are 100 companies. We're not one company. We're not set up like GE. And we have about $100 billion in revenue with 425,000 employees worldwide. And while we're an Indian-based group, about 60% of our revenue comes from outside of India. And almost 25% of the 425,000 employees are based outside of India. And before you ask, Shyam, no, they're not in California. They are actually all over. And in fact, much to people's surprise, we are the largest industrial employer in the UK with 44,000 employees. And in the United States, we employ 24,000 people, doing about $8 billion in revenue, and in diverse businesses ranging from hotels to IT. And yes, I'm glad that you did mention the Campton Hotel, because we are the only Indian-based hospitality chain in the United States. And so I always remind people that if you believe in job creation, stay at our hotels, because the money comes right back to the U.S. We are diverse and we are complicated, somewhat like the global economy. And what makes that difficult for us is that we don't have one set view as to how to approach a geography. Each of our companies, all 100 companies, have a different approach and a different approach to the global and local economies. For us, one size doesn't fit all. And in fact, out of our 32 largest companies, all 32 are publicly traded. So they all have their own boards, they all have their own management teams, and they all have their own strategies and philosophies. But I strongly believe that this corporate diversity has allowed us to look at geographies and regions like Asia and the United States in a different way. Now, Shyam had asked me to talk about Asia, and it's a very difficult question to tackle, and having lived in India for 4 years or 3.5 years, I've come to appreciate it. I've come to appreciate that there is diversity in the economic opportunities and struggles all throughout Asia, even within India. And each country and each state in India, let's say, has its own unique business and developmental needs. You know, India has its own culture. Southeast Asia follows different cultural norms. And there is China, Japan, Korea, all unique. And so how do you really look at the economic situation in that region? China has been battling a slowdown in growth and a change in leadership this week. And they are in a race for commodities and energy with India. Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal reported that Japan is close to falling into another recession. which had many of my board members nervous. Indian growth has also slowed down. Politics have brought the country to a screeching halt. Sounds familiar from last week. And its government must develop policies. Indian government must develop policies that will create 800,000 jobs per month to maintain its current growth. Then if you take the rest of South Asia, the rest of South Asia has to create approximately 200,000 jobs per month. The Indian subcontinent must create 1 million jobs per month in order to maintain its current growth needs. Even Indonesia, which has had incredible growth opportunities and has emerged over the last couple of years as one of the primary places to invest, has a jobs problem and has been moving into political and regulatory regime that can be seen as protectionist by many in the United States. But those in Indonesia and those in Asia say, hey, we're not as bad as the U.S. when it comes to protectionist policies. They have to do something to create jobs to sustain their economies. With all that being said, my colleagues and I feel that this is Asia's century, and that even during this current economic slowdown, an economy as vibrant as India is still growing at a rate of 4 to 5%, and China at 7%. 20 years from now, the best of the demographic dividend will manifest that the region will succeed in every major sector. And what is even more interesting is that the delta, the Southeast Asia delta, the Mekong delta there. They're projecting in the next 10 to 15 years that the middle class there will grow by 400 million. And that's not even including the growth of the middle class in India and China. And what's even more interesting, and why we're actually very bullish on Asia still, is that economists in Asia predict that by 2100, 40% of the world trade will be between just India and China alone. So prospects for Asia look good. So yes, while we continue to read in the papers and economic news reports that there are near-term concerns for Asia because of a number of factors, export and currency dependencies, countries' lack of political will for reforms, countries worried about where they are positioned on the value chain, we believe that as these countries mature, as they develop better business climates and their companies develop vibrant global business practices, the long-term fundamentals are very strong. And, you know, Dr. Kamath and I met last year in San Diego, and when we met, we had talked about this long-term growth, about Asia. And what's even more fascinating is that this long-term growth is going to be buoyed by a lot of fascinating innovation and people who are hungry, smart, and vibrant. That is what Asia has to offer. Now, as we as a group, we feel that we are built for the long term, to be a contributor to both the Asian, U.S., and global economic job growth success stories. And there are a number of reasons why that we are, but I'll talk about three that are relevant to today's discussion. As I mentioned before, we're not built like a traditional company or business group. 66% of Tata Sons, which is my company, which is the promoter company of the group, is owned by 12 charitable trusts. We have operated since the founding of the group more than 150 years ago, and as old as St. Mary's College, as I learned, with the desire that our businesses must give back to the communities in which they operate in. This is a fundamental operating principle of our group. You know, many people call Mr. Tata, for example, who's the chairman of Tata Sons, a billionaire. That's quite wrong. You know, he's not poor, but he's not rich either. His family in the early 1900s gave their wealth, their ownership of Tata Sons, to those 12 charitable trusts. And so he gets paid a salary as chairman of the various companies. And his family actually has a very, very small ownership of the group itself today. And because of this operating principle of our group being 66% owned by charitable trusts, the trusts and the Tata companies last year contributed more than $200 million to charitable causes and efforts. And as we grow and grow and grow, that number of $200 million will grow to $300 million, to $400 million. It's built into us. And this approach of giving back to communities has been embedded into our group, a belief in the long-term value of creation, not only for the companies, but for the communities in which we operate in. What this allows our companies to do is to look at long-term strategies, not to be penalized for taking a long-term strategy in a region or an economy, and to push aside short-term gains. Leaders are brought into this culture and are rated on this basis. It's fascinating when I was interviewed by Mr. Tata for the job. We talked for about 2 hours in Georgetown, and part of the conversation, he actually asked me questions for about an hour and a half, and some of the things that he asked me was, how do you treat your mother? Do you like your sister? All these other things. And after an hour and a half of these questions, these very personal questions, he says, do you have any questions? So I said, well, I do have a question. I said, I'm a policy guy. I've mainly gone in and out of the private sector and public sector. Can I go to Harvard Business School? Can I, learn business? And he looked at me, and he kind of thought about it for a second. He goes, look, I'll teach you business, but I can't teach you values. How you treat your mother and your family is how you're going to treat my company. So I kind of sat there for a second. I looked at him. I said, well, when do I start? He says, not so fast. I've seen this. This is not just talk. I'm a very cynical guy. Look, I'm from Jersey. I've worked in politics in D.C. It's hard not to be cynical. But they actually do practice what they preach, and I'm going to go into that in a little bit. And a lot of this is seen as we grow. A lot of our growth, our organic growth, was in India itself. A lot of our global growth has been through acquisitions. And everywhere that we've acquired companies like Jaguar Land Rover, Corus Steel, Tyco, Teleglobe, in each of those acquisitions that we have done, we have actually had the support of the employees and the workforce there. It's because they believe in what we're trying to do, which is the long-term growth and the long-term stability of a company. And it's fascinating, too. People say, how did you turn JLR around when Ford couldn't do it? Mr. Tata has this one point that he always says. He goes, let JLR be a car company. Let people do what they're good at doing. Don't interfere. And he says you will be surprised as to how people will operate. So just give them the financial backing and let them grow. Let them take their time. Don't put any pressure. Two more points. We have been steadfast in refusing to take the easy path and falling in line with corrupt practices. And we've lost out on many bargains. A very famous story has been that, the Tata family has been pioneers in the airline industry, started what was now known as Air India. Used to be called Tata Airlines, and there's a lot of stories about how Mr. J.R.D. Tata, the founder of the group, supported that airline. Well, there was an opportunity for us to come back into the airline business in India, and there were some requests that were made to our group as to if you enter, these are some of the things that are expected, and Mr. Tata walked away from the deal. He was upset for a very long time, but he would not give up his principles to make a dollar, and I think that's very important. And more importantly, because of our heritage and the care for the community and care for our employees, this meant that we are meant to treat people with respect and dignity. And what is this all doing? As we grow globally and as we are we're seeing that Asian companies are maturing, what we're seeing is that there's a drive for commitment to stronger companies, institutions, and communities. And they have been supported through these new emerging organizations in Asia and third-party organizations. We can get into this in the Q&A, but the rise of activist organizations in Asia is really leading to sustainable, ethical companies, value-driven companies. I have 2 or 3 minutes left. So in conclusion, what does this all mean? What does it mean for a company like the Tata Group? With greater trade between companies and the growth of Asian-based multinationals and the presence of large companies like Tata and SAP and others in many geographies, we hope this encourages other companies to be fully transparent in the way that they do business. In 2 weeks, I'll be in Bangalore with my colleagues from around the world, from the UK, US, China, Singapore, Malaysia, Zambia, and a few other countries, and we'll be there doing our business excellence program. And for 2 days, business excellence leaders from around the world within our group are going to get together in a room like this, and we're just going to talk about best practices. And what we're hoping is that through these interactions, we add value to each other. And what is expected to us, from us is to go back, So I go back to Washington, and then I communicate this to all the 24,000 employees that are sitting around the United States, hopefully taking a very global approach to business excellence. And we believe, as a group, that strong corporate values are the backbone, the foundation for sound corporate action. And those corporations that recognize and practice it like us, or at least we aspire to be, will be insulated from economic downturns that you're seeing in Asia and poor corporate decisions. You know, I have a colleague of mine, Shubro Sen, who said that strong corporate values is like good nutrition and preventative medicine for business and societies. And what we're hoping is that you can be good for the community and you can still make money at the same time. I'm just going to end with a quote from my chairman who talked about how we take a very long-term approach, and I think this is the way to promote corporate sustainability and good practices. So he was on CNN, and the interviewer asked him, "What do you want your legacy to be? How do you want to be remembered?" Mr. Tata responded, "I think what I would like to do is to leave behind a sustainable entity of a set of companies that operate in an exemplary manner in terms of ethics, values, and continue what our ancestors left behind, not my legacy alone, but the continuation of the legacy that extends over the last 100 years. And I hope my successor will be as committed to that desire as I've tried to be." Thank you for inviting me, to allowing me to talk to you about my group and to giving you a small peek into the Tata organization.
Thank you very much, Kapil, for providing us with both a very interesting and provocative view from an Asian, specifically the Tata Group's perspective and the order of speakers. This is a very good segue given the origin of the Tata Group in terms of the 12 foundations that have social purposes into introducing our set of questions for Mike Fox, President and CEO of Goodwill Industries of Silicon Valley, for the social enterprise and perhaps North American perspective. I can't promise narrow questions. As a corporate leader who has served both as CEO for a pure for-profit corporation and now as a CEO of social enterprise that plows its profits back into serving societal needs, you have a unique perspective perhaps on the role of business in the post-financial crisis. For example, could better corporate governance at Countrywide, Goldman, Fannie Mae, and others have forestalled collapse? Did unbridled pursuit of profits, in particular in the financial sectors, cause the recession? Given that the corporate world's hands and reputations have been sullied by potentially bringing on financial ruin, can they be trusted to do the right thing in bringing us out of the current economic difficulties? Do we need a more balanced regulation, or indeed, some would argue, a regulation at all, to restrain the animal spirits of corporate titans or better corporate self-governance, if such a thing exists? A host of questions open up regarding the role and promise of social enterprise. Can social enterprise take on the role of alleviating poverty and providing livelihoods to those at the base of the economic pyramid? What role, if any, depending on point of view, should governments play to encourage social enterprise and decentralized enterprise solutions? Mike, could you perhaps try to summarize the situation in North America in light of these developments and the questions they raise in your mind so that we can more readily understand what to expect from the world's still richest economic area?
Well, thank you, Jim. Sitting up here, I kind of feel a little bit intimidated. First, you guys in the audience, and then Kapil and Peter did awesome presentations, but that's not really it. It's having to do a presentation in front of your former professor and learning what your grade's going to be at the end of this.
I'm not grading tonight.
Good. Thank you, Sean.
And that's a done deal.
Okay. Well, so your first question regarding the role of Wall Street and could better corporate governance have prevented the economic meltdown? In short, I think yes, but that's not the whole story, in my opinion. And I'll give you my perspective, which really comes from, I think, a little bit different level than the other two speakers you've had. It really comes from about 29 years of small business experience. I've never been in a large corporation and been more of an entrepreneurial atmosphere. But it also comes from a pretty broad political experience like Kapil, though probably a little bit more grassroots than him. I didn't work for a governor or a senator or a congressman, but I did a lot of volunteering in campaigns. I served in a lot of kitchen cabinets for local officials, congressmen, mayors, things like that. And so I kind of learned the political game since I've been about a young person just starting out. But I don't see myself as an economic expert. So it's more of an experience from that entrepreneurial and that political experience and that grassroots kind of thing. So take it as that it is. So that question, it would be easy in that question to just say, well, yeah, let's blame Countrywide, Goldman, Shearson, Fannie Mae, and hell, let's throw all of Wall Street in there and every bank, and then we're done with it. But I don't see it that way. I look at it as a shared responsibility. I don't believe the collapse we experienced could have happened without a great partnership. That's really what it was. The partnership of government, the financial industry, speculators, home buyers, and consumers. And then you add the tools of globalization and technology, and you have a culmination of decades of successful collaboration. And I go back to the Reagan era and to see all that as it built. The reasons were many for this partnership. Of course, a lot has been talking about greed, but a lot of political in nature, too. Banks and Wall Street funded both political parties over the years in the pursuit of constant deregulation and special treatment, and they certainly got it. Government's goal also was to lower the threshold, financial threshold for home buyers, make home ownership more affordable. And it's a laudable thing to do, but was it the right thing to do? There was also the frenzy of speculators who leveraged debt to turn homes quickly at enormous profits, and that went on for quite a while. And then potential home buyers who now found an easy road to home ownership. And finally, the consumers, too, who continued to spend beyond their means. At the time of the collapse, our savings rate was less than 1%. And when the collapse occurred, their spending ceased immediately because there was no more sources of funding for them for their borrowing. They couldn't borrow anymore. So all of a sudden, you saw how quickly in 08 we went into a recession. The pendulum had swung too far, and it was too late to stop the pending crisis. Kind of reminds me of growing up in Silicon Valley, the dot-com bust. And, you know, I remember a time when dot-com companies actually value would drop when they didn't lose enough money. Some of you who are old enough will remember that. It was pretty crazy out there. They'd report earnings. I remember Amazon reporting earnings, and losses, and their stock dropped because the analysts said they didn't lose enough money. So to me, economic and financial fundamentals were not only ignored, but many people in Silicon Valley preached and believed that a new economic model had been invented. I think the same kind of thing occurred in 2008. But then when you add a lack of transparency and a level of complexity that few financial CEOs or government leaders understood, what did you end up with? An out-of-control market open to abuses by government, businesses, banks, computers, consumers, and speculators. And you also got a rigged game against those who could least afford to play that game. You know, it's interesting. I remember once reading about Joe Kennedy, who was the father of John F. Kennedy, our former president. And he was asked how he got out of the market just perfectly timed before the 1929 stock market collapse. And he responded, you know, he knew it was time to get out of the market when the person who was shining his shoes started giving him stock advice. And I think the only I think that we had one Joe Kennedy in the group of those financial institutions. I think Goldman Sachs was right there with them. But everyone became an expert on investing in mortgage-backed securities, buying and selling homes for investment purposes, and people really truly believed in a new paradigm. You could own a home with no money down, there was cheap interest, and home values were just going to keep soaring anyway, so you're going to build equity very quickly. And this in turn also fueled an economic boom as houses grew and people invested in their houses, and, you know, the Home Depots and Lowe's of the world and everybody else who has a stake in that did very well. Of course, now we know that was kind of a false paradigm. So it took an extraordinary partnership to get where we ended up in 2008. You know, this crisis also reminds me of a plane crash. There are many redundancies built into aviation safety, so it's usually not one thing that causes a crash, but a collection of inconsequential errors that begin small, building on each other until you get an out-of-control situation. And then there's an inability to see what is happening, denial, and then panic and disaster. As far as trust goes, there's enough distrust that can be shared by both government and industry. The real question is, does the business sector owe a free market system anything but playing by the rules? Do they bear responsibility for greater transparency than required? Should the business community be proactive in self-regulating itself? And can business successfully balance corporate social responsibility with maximized returns to shareholders? And then what's government's role? Can government balance the need for economic growth and regulation? I would argue that the long-term solution is when the business community sees its greatest potential for return when it's actively engaging in social responsibility. And I didn't always think that. When I worked in for private sector, really didn't focus on that so much. A little bit, we were involved in some recycling stuff, but I really was focused on, you know, the bottom line, the return. And sure, we did nice things for our employees and for the community, but it really the bottom line was the more important thing. The opportunity is great for a larger economic return when businesses and consumers have a greater faith in our system, when they believe that the system is fair and not rigged against them, when regulation is balanced with freedom to pursue economic opportunity. So now the pendulum, like it always does, has swung the other way, and I think too far. Look at our response and its consequences. We now have Dodd-Frank. For those not familiar with Dodd-Frank, it's a financial regulation act that was passed in response to the meltdown in these financial institutions. It's now the major business issue of the day. When you talk to a lot of banks, you talk to a lot of companies, you talk to especially small community banks. And yes, I do believe some re-regulation was necessary, but now small businesses have a difficult time getting loans. Small community banks that help drive small business sustainability choke on the increased regulations. While we continue to grow the share of the large banking institutions at the expense of the small banks, we may actually be increasing the too-big-to-fail institutions by over-regulating. I don't know if anybody's really thought of that. But the financial institutions and the business community have to take responsibility for their role as well. They were hardly unwilling partners and did much to contribute to this pendulum swing, as they speculated with depositors' money, invested in securities that they did not understand, and borrowed significantly, focusing on short-term returns at the expense of long-term gains. C-level executives were paid enormous bonuses. We all read about that. Failure was rewarded with generous severance agreements. Additionally, you know, the key institutional investors who have the most say pretty much keep silent. They just kept playing the game as well. So I believe a sustainable economic system must demand transparency in the boardroom. Selection criteria for boards should be scrutinized more by investors and the community. Diversity should be increased not only culturally, but experience as well. In the past, boards have been led by an old boy network with CEOs sitting on each other's boards, granting each other generous stock options with very little transparency in the process. Not a great way to build faith and credibility. And I actually saw that. I dealt with a lot of my suppliers that were like that. Your second question regarding social enterprise, to me, is a fascinating discussion opportunity. And I think an area of business that is least understood by many in our community and industry. Can the business community learn from social enterprises like Goodwill? Coming from leading a private sector company to now leading a social enterprise, my answer would be yes, yes, yes. Let me begin with our mission. At Goodwill Silicon Valley, our mission is to support our employees, our customers, and people with challenging barriers to employment, to raise their standard of living and improve their lives through our services and social enterprise. That's quite a mouthful, and I know that, but sometimes when you put teams together, that's what you get out. It's much easier for me to, I kind of sort of think of it in this way. We improve lives through the power of work. It's real easy for me to do it, to describe it that way. And that's what we really do. Most people think of Goodwill as a thrift shop and a place to drop off unwanted clothes and household items. It's far more than that. When I give tours of our headquarters facilities, the number one thing I hear after the tour is, I had no idea. We kind of have a joke at Goodwill. We kind of call our tour the I had a no idea tour. But our Goodwill runs 19 retail stores. We have a wholesale donated goods business. We have e-waste recycling, mattress recycling, e-commerce division, contract work division, secure document shredding business, and a few other businesses as well. On top of that, our mission services organization has an annual budget of $3.2 million. My role at Goodwill has allowed me to experience and lead a team that is focused on the true bottom line. I've come to believe that in focusing and growing a business model that emphasizes people, planet, profit for our team has positively affected our community in more profound ways than at any time in our 85-year history. This focus has come with record revenue, record growth in reserves, and a record financial contribution to our mission services. In 2008, I got there in November of 2008, we lost $2.7 million that year. And we contributed about $300,000 to our mission services. That was on top of about a $1.2 million loss the year before. If you look at this year, we'll grow our net worth by $3.2 million in 1 year. We'll contribute $1.5 million to our mission services. We'll invest over $3 million in construction projects that benefit our community. We'll employ over 650 people, and of those 650, 250 of them will have be our mission employees, people who we are trying to transition into jobs outside of Goodwill. And they'll have various barriers to employment. We work with people like ex-offenders, homeless veterans, at-risk youth, people from situation and generational poverty, and people with disabilities. Additionally, we've decreased our landfill costs from $1.1 million in 2008 to $390,000 last year, at the same time generating an additional $325,000 in revenue from recycling efforts. And we also employed an additional 8 employees who have barriers. It's not, you know, big Fortune 500 kind of numbers, but for small Goodwill like us, it's a pretty good success. This year, our return on equity will be over 31%. I mean, how many companies would love to have a 31% return on equity? So I'm pretty proud of the team at Goodwill. So if one small Goodwill can do all this, what could be done if the large sector of the business community took this approach? There are large companies that are doing just that. We have two fine examples tonight in SAP and Tata Sons. And they are both implementing environmental stewardship into their strategic long-term plans. You know, there's another company, too, that's doing this, Unilever. And that's a great example of bold, sustainable leadership and strategy. CEO Paul Polman has set a goal to double revenues by 2020 and at the same time reduce their environmental impact by 50%. Unilever has also set a good example of how you can provide affordable products to the base of the pyramid and still return a profit by leveraging their existing supply chains and markets. I think we can all learn from SAP, Tata, and Unilever. My role at Goodwill has allowed me to see another issue, and that is of hiring practices. You know that people with disabilities have a 74% greater unemployment rate than people without a disability? At Goodwill, we have begun innovative job programs that look for the ability in the disability. One example is our new e-commerce platform. We now have approximately 12 young adults working for us who are in the autism Asperger's spectrum. They work in listing books and collectibles online. Not only are we providing jobs, but we're profitable, and we have 12 people, most who have never held a full-time job, contributing to our profits and to the economy, and they're productive. I look at them as our true heroes in our organization. A little over a year ago, the leader of our loss prevention unit, a former lieutenant with the San Jose Police Department and a former commandant of the San Jose Police Academy, came up with an innovative program to provide security guard card training. He developed a program that provided 40 hours of training versus the 8 hours that security companies provide. This gives the full training required by the state that's done over 2 years. We do it in 40 hours. In addition, we provided enhanced classes in report writing, employability skills, and then also 40 hours of on-the-job training. This gives our people a great advantage when applying at security companies where job growth has been robust. When we started, we thought we'd be training mostly young adults, but a high number of people are coming in to us with college degrees and even graduate degrees, and a lot of them are over the age of 50. They've been unemployed since 2008, and they tell us no one will hire them. it includes people who are managers in high tech, engineers who are in high tech, skilled workers. I believe this is a big problem in Silicon Valley. Firms will not hire older or unemployed workers, no matter the experience. We need to rethink our hiring processes. If we only hire younger workers, what does that do to our economic markets? How are we going to grow those markets if, as a whole, we shrink the buying power of those over 50? It's not good business. Business has a responsibility to its shareholders to work to expand markets. We need to change attitudes like we did in the 60s and 70s and 80s with recycling and energy conservation. We need to add human sustainability. We can realize better, more sustainable returns, but it will take a culture shift for this to occur. My experience running a social enterprise leads me to believe that industries that commit to human and environmental sustainability will reap large rewards over the long term. It's not unlike being first to market. At Goodwill, we look at the long-term business opportunity in every program we implement, like our mattress recycling program that employs homeless veterans in transition. After 3 unprofitable years, we will sustain a profit this year. But the last 3 years may have been unprofitable from a dollar standpoint, but if you look at the return on human capital, we've had over 230 formerly homeless veterans, many with substance abuse issues and or ex-offender status, placed into permanent jobs, a 75% success rate. This year, we placed over 80 veterans in jobs. When starting our guard card program to employ people in the security industry, we created a model that over time will allow us to charge to place people and have a sustainable economic model. I believe there's much to be learned by social enterprises like Goodwill, Salvation Army, and Catholic Charities, but we also learn from profit organizations as well. When I began at Goodwill, I had a very different impression about nonprofits than what I found. In the Goodwill movement, I found over 110 years of social and capitalistic innovation, committed and enthusiastic leaders, willingness to share success and failure with others, and a drive to grow people, planet, profit. At Goodwill, we also collaborate with government, and I see a very need with that, with shrinking budgets and the need to restrain debt. It's created a great opportunity for partnership between social enterprise and government. But I still see government institutions holding on to those bureaucracies. So while they may be willing to work with us, they really kind of just give us a little bits of crumbs, but they really don't want to eliminate their bureaucracies. In fact, they want to continue to grow their bureaucracies. So there's a real issue there. Government doesn't have to nobody votes on government bureaucracy every day on whether it's successful or not, but we do. Our community votes for us every day through our 700,000 donors a year, shopping in our stores. We have over 1.5 million transactions a year, 4,000 people who enroll in our services. Our board reviews our bottom line every quarter when we have our meeting, and they demand success for us. We benchmark, measure, plan, and execute just like any other business. One other issue that needs to be raised regarding social enterprise, and it's kind of a touchy issue, but I just wanted to raise it, is compensation. Social enterprise requires a rethinking in this area, I believe. While I'm happy with my compensation, in many cases the public does not understand the nonprofit world. They believe that people who enter the nonprofit world only do so based on a desire, because they have a passion to help those who are in need. And, of course, they do. But you can't just drive the performance of the organization based on people of passion. You need talented, good people that have that passion. The nonprofit sector social enterprise needs to attract is the best talented, the most successful. And that is hampered by the public attitude. They don't like to see high salaries with people that work in nonprofits. Let me just give you a couple of examples. In the Wall Street Journal, Dan Pallotta, a well-known advocate for social enterprise, writes about how the CEO of Boys and Girls Club was being criticized by a group of senators because his salary was almost $1 million. Sounds like a lot, right? But they ignored the fact that he had tripled the revenue of the organization to $1.5 billion in 8 years. Another interesting statistic is how many nonprofits have crossed the $50 million line in annual revenue since 1970? A couple thousand, 10, 15,000? No, 144 since 1970. How many for-profit businesses? 46,132. If social enterprise is going to really solve the issues of the day, we're going to have to get serious about compensation and being more open to failure and risk as well. People don't like it when nonprofits go out and spend money and maybe don't always succeed. But there's one exciting innovation that could replace the traditional social enterprise model. That's of the B Corporation. B Corps are for-profit companies that have a social mission. They have better access to capital because they can tap equity markets. They can hire the best and the brightest and compensate appropriately. And they can have a profit motive as well. I believe that this is the most exciting opportunity for the future of social enterprise and alleviating society's problems. And in closing, in the end, is social enterprise the solution to alleviating property and the problems associated? I do not believe so. There has to be cooperation and collaboration between our communities, our governments, the industries in our communities, social enterprises, and other nonprofit organizations. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike, for your perspective from the point of view of social enterprise. I think you raised a number of questions which will need to be answered as we go along, but definitely the link to how corporate social responsibility can be built in to what we do comes through. I want to thank the panelists for their excellent overviews of the role of governmental and corporate responsibility in the post-crisis world. We will return to these themes. As you notice, we have now a number of questions, and that's what we'll be doing for now. We will both use both these written questions that have been given to Dr. Hawley and me, and what I will do is we will ping-pong between the two of us. He will ask a question from those he selected, then I will ask a question, and we'd go back and forth. But please do step up to the mics. There are two mics, I believe, one on each side, should you wish to ask a question, and we'll fit you in. But before I do that, I have to remind our radio audience that we are continuing here at the Commonwealth Club. We want to remind our audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we are discussing corporate social responsibility in a post-crisis world. Our panelists are Mr. Michael E. Fox, Jr., President and CEO, Goodwill Industries of Silicon Valley; Dr. Peter Graf, Chief Sustainability Officer and Executive Vice President, SAP; and Mr. Kapil Sharma, Senior General Manager, North America, Tata Sons. I am your moderator, Dr. Shyam Kamat, Associate Dean and of Graduate Business and Global Programs at St. Mary's College School of Economics and Business Administration, joined by my distinguished colleague, Dr. Jim Hawley, Director of the Elfenberg Center for the Study of Fiduciary Capitalism at St. Mary's College of California. And now over to you, Jim, for the first question.
We are inundated with questions and too little time, unfortunately. So what I am going to do, I've tried to categorize some of the questions. Many of the questions are directed toward one of the three speakers individually, but I'm going to try to start with some general questions that all the speakers might comment on in their own way. And I'm going to try to combine three here, which may or may not work. One question, we'll find out. One question is, what is the value proposition for Exxon or Shell Oil to support climate change legislation such as cap and trade? Another question, today was a historic day for cap and trade, we should add in California, and sustainability in California. What can business leaders do to internalize externalities without government regulation and remain profitable? And perhaps a general question, of which that might be a specific, is, as Mr. Sharma discussed, looking at the long term, how can business do this, that is, look at the long term when investors are looking to quarterly profits? So if any of the panelists would like to comment on one aspect of that, those three questions or another.
Let me take the tough one on Exxon and Chevron, because it's a great question. It helps exemplify what happens when companies start thinking about sustainability and their business in the long run. And oil will last for a very long time. It will last much longer than we need to change the climate in a way that we can revert the situation. The question that companies ask themselves is, what is my purpose? And it sounds kind of silly and superficial, but think about this. At some point in time, Nestle changed its purpose from being a food company to being a company about health and well-being. And that had massive impact on how the company addressed a specific set of problems. I believe if you identify yourself as an oil company, you have a very different perspective regarding the world as compared to defining yourself as a company that enables mobility, for example. And that's the kind of thinking that usually starts with one person. And you mentioned Paul Polman, who is a fabulous leader, the head of Tata, and I've met some of those who run your businesses, including yourself. You have the ability to see the bigger picture. And that's what it takes. That kind of leadership is required. And these companies will change over time because you will force them to change through the way how you endorse their products, through the way how you use their products. And that's why I think that is the transformation that's going to happen. If we leave these companies alone and if we just say, you know, Exxon, just do oil, then they will always be in that kind of conflict unless we find a way to go and use the oil without pollution, without, you know, changing the climate and all those kind of things. But it comes down to the question of how do you define your own business? And it can be somewhat liberating. SAP went through the same thing. I was the second in command of marketing, and if I had just hung out there, I would be the running marketing right now. And when I was 40, the CEO back then asked me, so Peter, you know, you have your birthday coming up, how old are you going to be? I said, I'm going to be 40. He said, oh, 40 is a dangerous age. I said, what's wrong with 40, you know? Well, when people are at that age, they start asking all the difficult questions. And it was very difficult for me to be motivated by having yet another year of managing a fabulous pipeline and getting even more money into the company. I was missing the purpose. Why am I doing this? And we started the conversation within the company, and our purpose is much shorter than yours. We just say, we want to help the world run better through software. And we started to measure how we can better the world, and we created projects around that. And that changes the way how you go about the problems. So I think it's about how do you understand what is your mission in life? Is it oil or is it enabling mobility? And once you think that way, everything changes.
Okay. Anybody else? Mike?
Well, maybe I'll take it from a different perspective, just being coming more from the small business sector. By the way, the sector that employs 70% of the people in this country. And, you know, I hate to see things when government just mandates and puts things on business. And a lot of times larger, big, global, strategic organizations are able to handle those kind of mandates that get handed down. But small businesses, medium-sized businesses have a very difficult time with that. You know, I came from an industry that was very fuel-intensive distribution. And, you know, we did a lot to lower our carbon footprint, to save money and be more efficient. But we had a lot of things driving mostly our supplier or our customers' service decisions. When you're in the middle tier, you've got a lot of requirements on you. And so it's not always easy to do that. And so a 10-cent increase in a gallon of gas to us was serious money. It might be the difference between hiring two or three people for the year. So, you know, when you look at it from a small business perspective, sometimes these grandiose plans that government, you know, mandates and thinks that it's going to have all these great benefits, there's a lot more consequences that are unintended than people realize. And so a little bit different perspective, I think, than other people.
A couple?
I thought I would tackle how can a business look at the long term when analysts and shareholders are looking at short-term gains. You know, for our group, we have 3.8 million shareholders within all our companies. And the one thing that I've noticed when I'm reading about shareholder meetings is that we attract those kinds of people who want our company to take a long-term view. If you want a short-term view, you want a quick profit, you're just not going to invest in our company. And we back that up with success. And I think that's what we hope to show, is that you can take a long-term view, you can give back to the community, and you can succeed at it. And the thing is that there are a lot of companies in the U.S. as well, Whole Foods, other types of companies that are giving back to communities, that are showing profit, that are showing success, and they're attracting investors. So I think you're seeing almost like a pendulum swing now where people, after being hurt, I think, from the financial crisis, are saying, you know what, we want to take a long-term view. We want to invest in those sustainable companies. And I, you know, again, I'm that cynical New Jersey, D.C. guy, but I think, and it was what Peter said before, I think this is what people want. and people will invest in companies. We have faith in that. As long as we keep doing the right thing, the shareholders will give us the time to do what we need to do.
Well, thank you, the three of you, for that. But I think the New Jersey, I think I'm in California. I'm in New Jersey as I read these questions, because they all have a high degree of skepticism about corporate, the ability of corporates to deliver on what the three of you have been talking about. Because in spite of what you said, what comes through in all of these questions is a great amount of skepticism about the ability to corporates to deliver. Now, you did point out, two of you at least, if not all three of you, that infusing values and looking at the business as fundamentally from the point of view of a sustainable long-term view is likely to be beneficial. But here we have a question of, well, that's okay for the large companies, as Mike points out. For the small company, it's difficult. But especially, what is the way that this is going to become, besides your faith in us asking of that of companies, what else needs to be done? So there are at least three questions that here that intersect with that. What else do you see that is going to happen? Does it have to be, for example, we are a business school that has taken on a mission that looks at responsible leadership or responsible business as its core and looking at things globally. Is that what is required? So what are the other ways that this, you know, your companies have done this, but how are the other companies going to follow besides consumer demand?
You know, so we run a program, it's called Tata ISIS, where we take kids from the UK and the United States and we bring them to India to work on our corporate social responsibility programs, mainly working in villages throughout India. And being the only American at corporate headquarters in India, I was the de facto greeter of all foreigners that came to the corporate house. And it was fascinating to see the angst and the cynicism of Americans when they came to India. They just simply would not believe that the Tata Group could do this kind of stuff. They would spend 3 months working in our programs, and they'd come back and they'd say, okay, we're wrong. It's an American problem. And I think that's part of it. I think that, you know, in the U.S., we think this way. We are very cynical. Outside the U.S., I find cultures are much more trusting, or they believe more in the role of the company, and they demand it as well. Maybe we didn't demand as much from the corporates as we used to. I think if we start doing so now and we expect it from the companies, they will respond. It is very much a cultural problem, I think, for us. But it has to be through leadership. That's one of the ways. I mean, I know we'll preach it and we'll sing it and we'll dance for it. It has to come. Companies will be successful. People will follow it. I think we're a good example. We're at $100 billion. Our chairman said we have to hit $450 to $500 billion over the next 5 years. We're not going to do that by failing. We're going to do it by succeeding. And with that, we hopefully will bring a lot of other companies with us. And one of the other more interesting things that we do is that global platform. What I have to admit, coming from the United States, I lived in a very siloed world. I didn't start thinking outside the box until I started meeting people from other parts of the world and just seeing how they look. We as policymakers in Washington used to complain that, oh, this country is not opening up its market, and this country is not doing this, and this country is not doing that. When I lived in India, I was like, wow, these people are just like middle-class Americans. They have the same problems that we do. They just look at it differently. And so once you get people, I think, from different business backgrounds together, things start to change. And I think we have to do that more as an American culture here.
You know what I think, too, and those are all good points, is that there needs to be a culture shift in this country. And there always are culture shifts that occur from generation to generation. I mean, you know, if you look at when I grew up, when I was really young, nobody wore seatbelts and nobody recycled. And all of a sudden, when I got older, we all started wearing seatbelts. My parents, you know, now they wear seatbelts because we told them, you got to wear your seatbelts. But they didn't wear seatbelts. In fact, I had five other brothers and sisters. We'd be rolling around in the back of the station wagon as the station wagon was driving around. And I got very involved in the recycling movement. I started working in a recycling center when I was 10 years old. And my friends thought I was crazy. Me and my brother would go around all the construction sites picking up beer cans. We made $200 one summer as a 10-year-old kid. There wasn't really, recycling wasn't a big deal, but it started. It started with education. It started with people that really believed in it. And now look today, I mean, everybody recycles. Goodwill, we started the same thing with the donate movement. Now it's only a couple years old. It's not a big movement as of yet. We're working on it. And our goal is to increase donations overall to all charities. Just our Goodwill sends about almost 5 million pounds of textile to mostly Pakistan and South America, and that's on top of about another couple million pounds of shoes, where those clothes are sorted and they're sent out to entrepreneurs in countries all over Southeast Asia and South America and resold. We're generating business and income, but also those clothes are reused. And eventually a lot of the clothing also just becomes remilled into cloth again and turned back into clothing and gets sent right back here to the U.S. where we do it all over again. Now, it's small. It's maybe, you know, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds of clothing that's being done with. But if everybody started instead said, I'm not going to throw that T-shirt away or that piece of shorts or pants, I'm going to donate that to Goodwill, Salvation Army, a host of organizations – that's a way to start that movement on sustainability. Appliances, computers, all Goodwills take e-waste. We recycle that. There's a ton, though, that's not getting recycled out there. So it's about changing people's values. It's about us working better to make donating more convenient. We're striving to do that. We open a lot more donation centers because it really is about convenience. So that's one way that we can change the culture and get shifts in attitude. And it's really going to come from the kids and then forcing their parents into doing that. So that's a great way.
Peter said he would pass, so I just want the gentleman to ask his question.
Hi, my name is Peter Gisella, and Thomas Donahue, the president and CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, was here at the Commonwealth Club back in February, and I shared with him some information of my interest in a culture shift, or what Dr. Graf said in an article last May, a transformational change versus just an efficiency increase, or social responsibility regarding leveraging the selective service program into a positive feedback mechanism. This was a bill that was in the Congress 30 years ago that would have challenged youth between 17 and 18 to debate and talk and discuss about what is participatory democracy and doing constructive work activities, be it in the community or in the military. And some of the work would be contracted service where they would get compensation, and other parts would be volunteer work where they wouldn't get paid. Unfortunately, all the professionals I've encountered since 9/11 here at the Commonwealth Club, hundreds of them, have not been willing to think along these lines for some reason. And so I get near zero feedback, and so there's no discussion in our society about this strategy and our approach. So my question to you is, as sort of representatives of three different democracies, could you possibly analyze this impact as a corporate social responsibility strategy that could benefit our society in a sustainable way, increase our social cultural shift, and make things better for everybody, as they call the tide lifting all the ships?
Okay, I guess it's to me to start. I talked about the fact that it is very hard to engage employees in change, and we just heard the challenges of driving a cultural shift. And I've driven a whole bunch of projects within SAP that might help what I believe needs to happen on a grander scale. Because essentially what changes the way how people engage is if they understand the value proposition that comes with it, that is very different from what they initially expect. To give you a very simple answer or example, at SAP we try to create a culture of carpooling to work because it's an enormous waste of resource what's happening every day. And we started with creating awareness. That's step number one. In helping our people understand that every day we collectively commute from Earth to the Moon to Earth back to the Moon. every day. And you're smiling. In the U.S., we collectively commute from Sun to Neptune, and that's the entire solar system since we've kicked out Pluto. So it's been a lot. So what we then did was to give them something, because people want to change it once they understand the magnitude of the stupidity that's going on. They want to change it. So you have to have something that's very clear, saying, okay, here's a tool that can help you find carpool partners. You know, just put in your address and it's going to spit out the other guys, and here you can arrange this on your mobile device very quickly and easily. Okay, that's fine. And we launched this thing. It was a great success. But the incentive that we launched it with was not save some money. It was also not, save the planet. It was know the gossip. Because in a corporation of 50,000 where innovation goes on all the time, that's really what struck people. Meet new friends, know the gossip, know what's going on in the company. And that made it compelling. And the ultimate kick happened when the CEO started to participate in the program, because now you have the ability to be picked up by the CEO of a 60,000 people company to go and be driven to work by him. That's cool, yeah? But so what we usually do from a sustainability perspective is tell people don't be bad, do the right thing, but we're not giving them the truly compelling reason to act and to get to the individual. And I didn't understand that until I started volunteering in the U.S. As part of my work. And SAP has hundreds of thousands of hours of volunteering that we donate to the communities in which we work. We actually touch 1 million people worldwide through, you know, voluntary actions and volunteering of our employees. There is a gratification to have a human connection that goes beyond anything that someone could explain to me, but you have to do it. And that volunteering is not in the German culture, because we believe the state needs to take care of social questions. This is different here, and I love it, because it grabs people. And the conversation I can have inside the company about the social programs we run touches people's heart, and it makes them change their way more easily than any carbon conversation I can have with them.
I would ask if either of the other two panelists have comments, and I am unfortunately watching the clock and have a pile of really good questions, which we'll unfortunately not get to.
We'll pass then. Go ahead.
Okay. It is a little after 7:30, and let me encourage the people whose questions that I have, and I think Dr. Kamath has at the other end of the table, to approach any or all of the panelists and also discuss among yourselves, and apologies in advance. We could be here for another productive 2 or 3 hours. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, in closing, let me thank Mr. Michael Fox, Jr., President, CEO of Goodwill Industries of Silicon.
I think we have another half hour. It's 8 o'clock that we'll run to.
I apologize.
No, that's okay.
In which case, Sham, do you have some questions? Since I cut it short, and I take back the apology.
That's all right. That's okay. We'll get there, ultimately. But thank you. There are a few questions here which are very pointed and in terms of understanding what the dynamics is going to be. So I will try to, Peter, this is addressed to you. You pointed out that powerful politicians, because of the interest that they have in getting reelected, shy away from doing what is good for the long term very often. And you mentioned it in the context of the European Union and where it's going. And you were balancing it. But the question here says, what incentive do corporate leaders have to do the right thing? Because is it really any different? Because the profit motive drives them. And assuming that political leaders represent people and that corporate leaders really represent only shareholders, why will we see this happening? A related question to that is how in Indian culture, Mr. Sharma, the core belief is to do good but not talk about it, and then to believe in your good karma, and if you don't get it, that's what you do. But how do you then, in that kind of a culture, in spite of what Tata has done, create the need to do good? So the two questions are related in the sense that in the Asian culture, it looks like there's a built-in cultural issue which doesn't allow you to talk about doing good, so it doesn't spread as fast. But in the other culture, in Western culture, there's this self-interest issue which prevents things from happening.
I try to give a very short answer. I think that we are at a stage right now where you can, out of very selfish motives, start a very sustainable business strategy. Because the society rewards those companies who actually enhance their brand. You can have dramatic efficiency gains right away by looking at the bigger picture. You can have more competitive products because you innovate and the market is receptive to those things. You do not have to be, social and do everything just for the better good of society. You can do these things right now. And there are many examples like Nike, even SAP, Tata and others who make great profits by being more sustainable than other companies. So you can do this out of perfectly selfish reasons today.
I was going to say that. I don't understand why everybody's saying what's the incentive for companies to do this. The incentive is to make money. I mean, exactly. We're a business. We're not a charity at the end of the day. We happen to be owned by charitable trusts, but there's this huge firewall between the charitable trusts and the operating businesses, and in fact, the only link is Mr. Tata, who goes between the two. And so we're out to make money. And, you know, we have some of the biggest companies in the world. We're the largest telecom company. We're the second largest tea company. We're the second largest chemical company when it comes to soda ash, one of the largest car companies, one of the largest steel companies, and one of the largest IT companies. I don't know what more I have to say that you can make money, you can be one of the best in the world, and you can do it. There's no the incentive is already there. We're doing it. Now, that was a very interesting question, whoever asked about Indian culture and not talk about it and doing good. We had done that for a long time where we never talked about all our charitable donations. In fact, you used to get reprimanded if you talked about it in public forums, which made my life increasingly difficult as I took the job. But what we found was that we actually needed to talk about it. We needed to talk about it because we needed to do it from a morale perspective. Employees feel good if they're part of an organization that is doing good things. And we found that the more we talked about it, the harder that the employees worked, the more innovative that they became, because they wanted to be a part of a company like that. It's not perfect. There's still skeptics within our organization, mainly from the West, but we felt we needed to do it in order to really encourage it to be leaders, to encourage other companies to do it. It's fascinating. One of the things that Mr. Tata always tells us to do is to shake hands, to go out, to talk to as many people as possible, and encourage them to move into these kinds of businesses. The biggest influencer on us is an American. It was C.K. Prahlad from the University of Michigan, where we met at that conference. And it was an American who influenced us and said, you know what? You can do a lot to benefit the maximum number of people, the base of the pyramid, and still make a lot of money. And the example he always used is, if you could sell one ice cream to every single person in India for a dollar, think about how much money you'd make. And that's the mindset that we took, and that's where the Nano came about. That's where our $18 water filter came about. That's where our low-income housing has come about. A lot of that is driven by you can make money by doing a lot of good. And it's what you were saying before, which is you shouldn't feel bad about it.
Mm-hmm. Mike? Well, I just have to say I kind of briefly touched on it in my remarks. But, you know, at Goodwill, I mean, you look at our sustainability efforts. When I got to Goodwill at the end of 2008, that year we lost $2.7 million. One of the things we started focusing on was not only revenue growth, but how can we minimize our expenses? And I took you through the issue where we went into a strong recycling program. Took our landfill bill down from $1.1 million down to about $375,000, and generated another $300,000 in profits from selling those recyclables. That's over $1 million gain on just something in a small business like us. I mean, we do $40 million in revenues, and overnight we've got $1 million gain. I mean, so for us, the efforts in sustainability and the environmental side has really, really worked. We've also created our whole business based on taking other people's garbage, stuff that's going to go in a landfill. This year, we'll divert. We'll have donated close to 29 million pounds of things, and we'll divert probably 25 million of those pounds from landfill. You take our mattress recycling program. What a great program there. We were profitable. We're going to be profitable this year. And yet, not only are we making money from recycling mattresses, and we're charging people, but it costs you $10 to bring a mattress down to a Goodwill store. If you take it to the landfill, it's going to cost you $40. So it's a win-win. The consumer only has to pay $10. We get to get the $10 in revenue. We get to recycle it. We make another $3 breaking those components down on that land, on that mattress for $13. And guess what? We get to employ formerly homeless veterans who are in transition, and then use that program to get them hired into good paying, well, maybe not great paying jobs, but at least a lot better than being living on the street. And so I've seen, had a real awakening in education that as you do these things, not only can you make money, but it opens up new markets to you and opens up new opportunities. And so that's my opinion.
Right. I have three questions here, which in a sense bring us back to, Peter, where you started, but I'd certainly invite all the panelists to comment. Let me read the three questions. My first question is to Dr. Peter Graf. It's about Euro economic crises. What was the cause? You've spoken partially about that. Is there any progress, in your opinion, going on right now, or is it getting worse and worse? Please, can you explain it precisely? But I have another question. Can you give me examples where austerity measures have been successful in solving economic problems? That's certainly a macro and economic theory problem, among other things. And finally, perhaps directly up your alley, thank you for your insights into the euro. What does your artificial intelligence model predict about the final outcome of the European crisis? Resolution or disaster?
Beautiful. Let me answer the last part of the question first. There is a reason why I went from studying artificial intelligence to, running a business. That's when my natural intelligence kicked in. So let's leave that aside, but it's a fun question. Thanks for asking it. The European crisis and the details around the euro, and are we making progress and have austerity measures ever helped? Let's put it this way. Austerity measures helped Greece from collapsing. You can say that pretty clearly, because without those austerity measures, they wouldn't have received any money from anybody. Nobody would have loaned them anything. And frankly, all of the money that is talked about hasn't really been transferred. Nobody has bailed them out. It's all about guarantees and credits. So the case that Greece can't pay anymore, that's when all the guys actually need to start paying, and that's when it's going to get interesting. But I said there is lots of stake in Europe, and I cannot imagine that the European leaders throw the idea of European integration away. And I also do not believe that it's going to help if they have, and some people talk about having a northern euro of, Germany and France and the Netherlands and the strong economies, and then a southern euro. That won't help either, because you're building one artificial big, huge divide in the middle of this. And then you again have all the challenges with the currency exchange rates. So, frankly, what's happening right now is that we are at a moment where the political leaders in the countries in Europe are struggling with the fact that they need to give power away. The European Union has done that with one Secretary of State. I don't know if you've heard about that. So there is a Secretary of State for Europe. And there has been much more coordination around the challenges around military responses to crises. So it's happening, but it's happening very, very slowly. At the same time, people get more and more impatient because, frankly, the real problem that I see right now is a generation problem with unemployment. You have to imagine that there are countries like Spain where half of the youth younger than 25 is unemployed. That is crazy. I mean, imagine this society when the older people have, they have their sheep in the dry, as we say in Germany. So, everything's cool, great salary, great job security because we're in Europe. And the young people just don't get a job. They can do whatever they want. They run from, one internship to another, but they don't get a real employment. And that's a generational conflict that must be resolved. That's not necessarily a problem of the euro. I think that's a problem of the whole bubble that you so nicely described, which exploded in everybody's face. And that forced everyone to bring that, you know, the interest rate down on a global basis to stabilize and to pump money into the economy. And then, you know, you shouldn't be surprised if people amass debt when it's very cheap to amass debt. So those are very, very complex things. Austerity measures is the way that the European Union is going about, because what they do not want to do is to go and tell the Greeks, okay, we'll bail you out. Because then, you know, what do you do with Portugal and Spain and Italy? And those economies are way too big to be bailed out. Italy's GDP is 60% of that of Germany. If Italy collapses, that's a real problem. And there is no economy big enough to carry that weight for the Italians. That's the problem. It's the domino effect. Greece itself, the GDP is smaller than the GDP of Toyota and, you know, Lower Saxony, which is one of the smaller states in the 16 states of Germany. So we're talking about a very, very small thing, but the symbolic character of this domino to fall is huge. And that's why everyone's holding it together right now.
Well, I realized that I was looking at the wrong clock because that clock is slow. So there's just 5 minutes left. So I'm just going to ask the last question, and it's to all three of you. I think you've addressed this, but I've got at least four people asking the question. It is the feeling that while corporate enterprises and social enterprises can deal with the issue of society and can deal with issues that have to do with some of the other things that you've talked about, they don't do such a good job with regard to environmental stewardship. So what is it that corporate leadership can do about environmental stewardship? I know, Mike, you mentioned a number of items, but what is it that will make environmental stewardship bring its center stage for corporations?
Well, from my perspective, I think really the number one thing will be, is there a profit motive to doing that? Either lowering the cost of doing business or an ability to be able to generate revenue. I mean, we're seeing a lot of that in Silicon Valley now. We've got a lot of energy companies now. The whole electric car industry is probably going to be a boom for Silicon Valley. I mean, batteries and different components that are being made in the valley. Solar companies, you know, we've got large solar companies in Silicon Valley, and I realize, notwithstanding the cylinder debacle, that's when you get a problem when governments try to pick winners and losers. But we should be investing in the industry itself, and it should be looked as a long-term play. There's lots of opportunity there. And a ways for to create jobs, to create an ability for companies to save money, to further our resources and have them last longer. So those are many of the ways at Goodwill. You know, we've done a good job, but we have a lot more to do. There's other Goodwills that are doing a lot better than we are in this situation. We've only really been into it for 4 years. There's Goodwills that have been into environmental stewardship for over 100 years. You know, it reminds me of the United States Brewers Association. They've been involved in recycling since Prohibition ended in the 30s. I mean, it's kind of amazing when you think about it, but they've been doing it that long. So from my perspective, there's lots of opportunity, and if there's a profit motive and if consumers demand it, it's gonna happen, like Peter's been talking about.
2 minutes, Claude. Either one of you to address the question about environmental stewardship, especially a couple in economies in Asia.
Initially, our company was very bad. Our group was very bad when it came to environmental standards and environmental stewardship. We started changing after we made acquisitions, and we started collaborating with our European colleagues from the UK and Germany, which they really educated us as to that you can make money and you can still be good at, with the environment. And what we did was we saw over the long term, it's what the what Michael just talked about, was that consumers are demanding it, that if you want to be around for a long time, you have to be good in this particular area. Actually, one of the more interesting things that we noted, too, is that our partners require it. I went to, I don't know how many of you know Sodexo. Sodexo is one of actually the largest employer in the United States, a French-based company. And what they had talked to us about was that we wanted to pitch to sell them tea. We're the second largest tea manufacturer in the world. And they said, well, do you do sustainable farming? And our tea guys were like, well, they said, sorry. The presentation lasted only 10 minutes. Here you had a major tea company meeting with a very large food service company. It lasted only 10 minutes because we didn't have a sustainable farming policy. I can guarantee you within the next year, we had a sustainable farming policy. And it's fascinating how business and partners can force change and force change immediately. And I'm seeing more and more of this with major corporations getting together. It's going to take time. This is not an overnight fix, but we're moving in the right direction. And there's a lot of education going on, a lot of awareness going on. So I'm starting to lose my Jersey cynicism, and I'm starting to be much more positive on this.
Thank you.
Okay. I prematurely already thanked Michael Fox, the President, CEO, and Goodwill Industries of Silicon Valley, but I've not yet thanked Peter Graf, Chief Sustainability Officer and Executive Vice President of SAP, nor Mr. Kapil Sharma, Senior General Manager in North America, Tata Sons. We very much also would like to thank our audience here for their very good questions, and also those of you on radio and on the Internet. We would like to remind everyone who's present in the room to join us outside in the lobby for a post-program reception. I am Dr. Jim Hawley, St. Mary's College School of Economics and Business, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and St. Mary's College Graduate Business Alumni Council, the Elfenwerk Center for the Study of Fiduciary Capitalism, and the St. Mary's Net Impact Chapter, all housed in the School of Economics and Business at St. Mary's College of California, is adjourned. Thank you very much for joining the audience today and making it such a lively and educational evening.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.